Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Research published recently suggests that living beside a golf course could increase your risk of getting Parkinson's disease by up to 126%, with pesticide use on courses being given as a possible link. Now, while that American study was small, some experts have urged caution in relation to it. It is the latest to link the devastating disease with man-made chemicals. And Professor Tim Lynch, neurologist, joins me now to discuss Parkinson's and what we know about its causes. Tim, you're very welcome. Thanks
Morning,
for coming in. So what do you make of this study? 419 Parkinson's patients involved in this from Minnesota and Wisconsin in the United States. They match these people on gender and age to about 5,000 healthy people. Then that's how they came up with their figure.
Yeah, it's an interesting study. It comes out of a Rochester epidemiology study that's going back from 1991. And they looked at the charts and retrospectively see where the people who got Parkinson's, just over 400 people, whether they live close to golf clubs or not close to golf clubs, or whether they lived what would they call vulnerable water areas, which referred really to limestone, which often will have caverns beneath it so that the water would be rapidly through the limestone and potentially, if there are contaminants in the soil, would get into the drinking water. And they were able to show, I mean, about a double increased risk within if you were living within a mile of a golf course or if you were living within a vulnerable water area. Mm-hmm. It's a small study, as you pointed out, so you can't overly hang your hat on it. On the other hand, it does come on top of old data going back a number of years, really, which is kind of fascinating in that we know that Parkinson's certainly has a familial genetic component to it, which we think makes up to maybe about 10%. But we know that the other 90% sporadic may have a familial component, how they handle metabolites or contaminants or toxins or other things in the environment that increases your risk. And going back to the 1970s, there's a wonderful book called The Frozen Addict, which describes a very bright chemist in San Francisco who decided to make synthetic heroin for himself. Unfortunately, he made a mistake. And in that manufacture, he produced a drug called MPTP, which is a very specific toxin to the region of the brain where Parkinson's comes from. And a whole flurry of young men and women developed acute Parkinson's at the time in the 70s and early 80s. And a very astute neurologist noted that and then studied them and published it. And that MPTP toxin was noted to have a similar structure, at least secondary structure, to paraquat, one of the pesticides at the time. And hence led into a big amount of research in the 80s. Could environmental factors be the main issue with Parkinson's? And then from there, we got into genetics. And then we found a whole bunch of genes that can be associated with it. And now we're swinging back. Is an environmental factor and a genetic component. So it's a bit like the fertile soil. Maybe you inherit a particular way you handle toxins from a metabolic perspective, and then the seed is the environmental toxin, which might be exposure many, many years ago. We don't know that.
How long does it take for Parkinson's to start to show itself once it has begun to develop in the brain?
So there's a bit of debate about that. There are prodromal symptoms, and even before that, before someone gets any symptoms, you've got, unfortunately, ongoing changes in the brain. It probably is 10 to 20 years before you get any symptoms. So exposure to a particular toxin, it may be going back to early in adulthood, but you may not get the disease until you're in your 60s and 70s. And there is data to show that. There's an interesting study looking at various solvents. One called TCE was done in a Marine Corps unit in North Carolina that they showed it was a cluster of Parkinson's. And there's a concern about TCE that was used at the time for various things like dry cleaning and other things, that could be a factor that could lead to increased Parkinson's risk. We know that it can cause increased risk of cancer, but the Parkinson's risk seemed to occur many, many, many years later on. So you can get exposed to something, it can sit there, potentially do some damage, and then the process then cascades over decades before you get
symptoms. Whatever the cause, the rate of Parkinson's is definitely increasing. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, so it's the most rapidly increasing brain disorder worldwide. And we're not sure why that is. You could argue is that we're all living longer. which we are. I mean, the average age for women is 80, 83, 84. Men, we get to about 81 or so. If you look at the risk for neurodegenerative disease, of course, as you get older, it increases. So the 1 in 3 women will develop stroke, Parkinson's or Alzheimer's in their lifetime. 1 in 4 men. Alzheimer's disease is about 40% of the population, 85, will start getting Alzheimer's. So we have a tidal wave of neurodegenerative disease coming against ahead of us because of the aging population. However, even allowing for that, Parkinson's is starting to catch up on Alzheimer's. So it's not just age. There's something else that's actually increasing the frequency of it. And the hypothesis is that there's something in the environment. And is it some of these solvents, or could it be various things like pesticides, whether it's paraquat, whether rotenone, or different pesticides used that could increase the risk? And hence the study is intriguing, because pesticides use in golf clubs for greens and for fairways is quite common. Now, they may use, and that's changed over time. Obviously, they're trying to use less toxins in relation to pesticides in sprays. But there may have been exposure 20, 30 years ago that could still have an effect on the population that now people are getting Parkinson's.
Because the weight of this research now means that some people who work in your field describe Parkinson's as a man-made disease. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think that's probably maybe overstating it. I think certainly we see that people develop Parkinson's not commonly, because they have a familial tendency. And we know there are specific genes that can sometimes cause Parkinson's to go down through the generations, or they get what we call autosomal recessive disease, where you get a gene from mum and a gene from dad and you get Parkinson's. So there's a certain percentage of Parkinson's, maybe 10, 15% that have got a significant genetic component to it. The other components of Parkinson's where you inherit a genetic risk, we know. For example, there's a gene called GBA, which causes a pediatric disorder called Gaucher's. But you've inherited, it was noted by a very astute physician when she was a pediatrician looking after these children with metabolic disorder called Gaucher's, that she was noticing the grandparents had Parkinson's. So she studied that and noted that, found out that a carrier of one gene for GBA increased your risk of Parkinson's. If you got two genes, you got Gaucher's, but one gave you increased risk of Parkinson's. But it doesn't guarantee you causing it. It just increases your risk. Mm-hmm. So there are genetic components. However, in addition to that, maybe how we inherit our immune system, how we inherit our metabolic system, and how we deal with toxins differently, then could increase risk as well. So I think it's going to be contributing from an environmental, possibly man-made, maybe pesticide solvents, in addition to the fact is how our makeup is. Like most disorders, you know, and human disorders, it's going have a genetic and an environmental contribution.
Right, so it depends how you respond to these environmental factors as an individual. So this increase in cases then, how does that impact the work that you do, the patients that you're seeing, the level of Parkinson's coming through the door?
That's always a hard one for us to answer, because I pointed out we're kind of a bottleneck, because we have a particular interest in helping people or managing people with Parkinson's disease and other neurodegenerative disorders. So we get referrals coming in from all around Dublin, but also around the country and indeed elsewhere for assessment, both for diagnosis and management. So, you know, we have a lot of patients. We follow maybe 1,500 or so patients with Parkinson's disease out of the Dublin Neurological Institute at the Mater is where we look after them. However, we recognise that's kind of a biased cohort because of referral. We don't have a good incidence or prevalence of Parkinson's disease in the country. For a number of reasons. One, it's hard to do because Parkinson's is a clinical diagnosis and there are many mimics. We know, for example, even if in good hands, we get the diagnosis wrong initially about 1 in 10 times. And you've got to see the patient a second and a third time. That causes challenges because often we're under pressure to see new patients and not to see follow-up patients to try and get through waiting lists. And that's not good practice in Parkinson's disease. You've really got to look people 2, 3, 4 times to get it right and manage them correctly. What we need is a good epidemiology study, but we don't have it. But we guesstimate probably somewhere in the region of 15,000 people in Ireland have Parkinson's disease, but that's a guesstimation.
Okay, but some people may have Parkinson's and not know it.
Oh, absolutely. And I notice that all the time on when I have to watch television occasionally and I'll pick things up. And I can't stop myself. It's an 8. I'll pick up movement and I notice movement and somebody moves differently. They don't have an arm swing. They might have a tremor. And I notice people on the television. That looks funny. I noted Billy Connolly maybe a number, maybe 5 years before that.
In his gait, in how he was walking?
His left arm, he wasn't moving it correctly. I'd wondered about Vladimir Putin, but apparently that the KGB have a particular way they don't move one of their hands because they have to have it close to the gun to whip out the weapon.
Right.
But if you watch Vladimir Putin walking, his right arm doesn't swing. But anybody who's trained to do that, apparently.
That's interesting.
And I noted that a while back. Mm-hmm. Actually, even as an inauguration, it's the right arm doesn't budge. But that's trained into it.
Yes, that's for other reasons, we think. Yes. And then the face, there's telltale facial expressions or lack of them too.
Yeah. So we call that hypomimia. And often we think about, you know, we're chatting away, we often have different expressions all the time. But sometimes those the movement of the face is less, so the person looks sad or they just don't have much facial expression. In the ear of Botox, that's become more tricky because Botox, of course, decreases smiles and wrinkles, and hence
you've got to be
careful, not just relying on that. So we look for different factors, and you know, and there are a couple of cardinal features: slowness of movement, stiffness, the classic rest tremor, but sometimes can be mixed, sometimes stoop posture, poor balance, and then a peculiar thing called freezing a gait, where there's a motor ignition problem. The foot won't move when they try and stand up to go, and it won't obey the command from the brain to initiate forward, mm-hmm. which is a tricky symptom to treat.
And there is no cure?
No cure yet, although I'm always an optimist, and I think that we know that in neurodegenerative disease, including Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, that if you're proactive about various things about your brain, you can certainly look after yourself. You know, and I had three people in the clinic last week, all of whom have Parkinson's over 20 years and all are very busy. So you keep yourself intellectually busy, keep your sleep well, exercise, good diet, maintain social contacts, and make sure your blood pressure and sugar levels are well controlled. So there are a bunch of variables that keep your brain healthy, so your 100 billion neurons may remain intact, but in particular that you generate those synapses, those connections from neurons to each other. And that gets driven by education and driven by reading. And I noted the piece earlier when you were speaking about cutting the funding to the WHO and loss of Mike, which is a big loss, because he would have driven various activity, like research into various things. That's key. Research into medical and scientific conditions drive new ideas, new research, new treatment. And underfunding these things, including the WHO and NIH, is short-termism and incorrect, mm-hmm. not a good move, and it's not good for people.
Well, you must look on with despair then at what's happening to research budgets in the United States. But is there some hope there on the European side that these American researchers might gravitate towards this part of the world?
That's possible, but that's a hard pull. I mean, you're dealing with people who've obviously embedded and got anchors,
yeah.
and they've got family and stuff. But that's certainly a possibility. But I think the United States has been the powerhouse for medical and scientific research for the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, funded particularly by the NIH. And the cutting back of the NIH funding is really worrisome. I give a brief example. The Elan company, the Irish company, was very clever. They produced a drug for MS that changed MS. When I was training, I had no treatment for patients with MS. Tysabri cut relapses in MS by 2/3. However, a certain number of people developed a brain infection due to a virus called PML. And that was disabling or killed them. There would be no treatment for it. So the drug got withdrawn from the market. Elan was a funny, interesting company. Rather than shelve it like most pharma companies, they did the science. They went back and looked at it and said, why is that? And they found out that half the population would have had a JC virus infection, which was a benign kidney infection, didn't bother it. And the virus then sat dormant in the kidney, doing no bother. However, when you run to Sabri, sometimes the virus got reactivated, got to the brain and called PML. And they figured that out. So that meant 50% of the population who had never JC virus were at no risk of getting it. Drug came back in the market, phenomenal drug. Mm-hmm. So do the science, get the data, patients benefit from it. And underfunding the research at NIH in the US is a problem.
Tim, it's always great to talk to you. So interesting. And thank you for coming in. That's Professor Tim Lynch, who is a neurologist. Now, coming up later on, Rory McIlroy is going to make his major return later on today at Quail Hollow. Next up, Micheál Martin has slammed councils over their approach to refurbishing local authority homes. We're going to hear why.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.